She spoke to the stone wolf at the palace gates every dawn, until it spoke back. Her grandmother had a saying, worn smooth as river glass from so much use. Every stone remembers the hands that shaped it. Marin Ashvale grew up thinking this meant pottery, or maybe the old chimney in their two-room cottage that her great-grandfather had laid by hand a century ago. She would run her fingers along its mortar lines before bed, feeling for the memory her grandmother promised was there. It was only later, after the palace, after the wolf, after everything, that she understood her grandmother had been speaking about people all along. Chapter 1. The Morning Ritual. The capital city of Veldrath woke in stages. First the bakers, then the draymen, then the market sellers with their precarious towers of crates. Last of all, just before the palace gates opened for the day's petitioners, came Marin. She was 23, lean in the way that came from missing meals rather than discipline, and her hair was the color of old honey, the kind left in the jar until it crystallized, amber shot through with threads of dark gold. She worked as a laundress for the palace auxiliary staff, which meant she never entered the palace proper. She handed clean linens through a low iron door in the eastern wall and received dirty ones in return, like some transaction between two worlds that could not bear to look at each other directly. But before the linen door opened each morning, she walked to the front gates. The gates themselves were iron and enormous, adorned with the crossed spear sigil of the Veldrath crown. Flanking them on stone pedestals stood two wolves, each carved from a single block of gray-white granite, each about the height of a large man at the shoulder. The sculptor, dead 200 years and largely forgotten, had worked them into a posture that was neither attacking nor at rest, but that peculiar alert stillness of a wolf that has heard something interesting in the dark. The one on the left had a small chip in its right ear. That one was Marin's. She couldn't have told you when the habit began. Somewhere in the first weeks after she'd come to Veldrath, alone and recently orphaned, taking the laundry position because it was the only work she could find, she'd started stopping at the gates on her way to the eastern wall because the wolf looked the way she felt, present at the threshold of something, unacknowledged, watching. She talked to it the way some people talk to graves. "Cold this morning," she told the wolf, pausing with her empty canvas sack over one shoulder. Frost still silvered the cobblestones. "They'll want extra blankets sent up, and I'll be told about it as if I'd chosen the weather." The wolf stared over her head, with its chipped ear and its millennium of patience. "Also," she added quieter, "I had that dream again. The one with the river. I woke up, and for a moment, I thought I was home." Then she squared her shoulders and walked to the linen door. She had no wolf form, no pack, no standing in any shifter hierarchy. She was wolfless, that particular Veldrath epithet that carried the weight of a whole social architecture in its two syllables. Her father had been wolfless, too. It passed, people said, through certain bloodlines, the way poverty passed, not as punishment exactly, but with the same reliability. The palace was home to the Alpha King Cairn Voss, who was said to be the most powerful shifter in 4 generations, whose wolf was reportedly the size of a young draft horse, and whose dominance aura could allegedly level lesser wolves to their knees at 50 paces. Marin had never seen him. She dealt in linens. He dealt in nations. These two facts were not in conflict. That was simply the shape of the world. Chapter 2. What the Head Laundress Said. 3 years into the ritual, a woman named Dresta took over as head of the auxiliary laundry. She was broad and efficient and had a talent for making organizational decisions feel like personal insults. "The wolfless one," she announced one morning to the assembled staff of 8, not using Marin's name, though she knew it, "will no longer be counted toward the staff allotment for palace feast days. You'll work them anyway, same as any other day, but you won't receive the feast bonus. The allotment is for recognized pack members." Marin kept her eyes on the pressing iron she was preparing. The metal ticked as it heated. "Recognized by whom?" The woman beside her, Betta, asked it quietly. "Just to Marin. not as a challenge to Dresta. "By anyone with a wolf," Marin murmured back. She did not argue. She had learned that arguing in rooms where you were already invisible tended to make you more invisible, not less. People heard you but chose not to register it, and you were left having spent yourself on empty air. That evening she stayed 2 hours late to finish a set of ceremonial tablecloths, for which there was no bonus, and then she walked home through the city's quieter streets, past the closed market stalls and the fountains that ran green with copper age. The next morning, at the gates, she told the wolf about it. "The thing is," she said, watching the sky go from charcoal to pewter to the pale silver pink that preceded actual dawn, "I don't even want the feast. I just want someone to say the word Marin in a room and have it mean something." She reached out. This was new. She'd never touched the wolf before. And pressed her palm flat against its stone flank. The granite was shockingly cold. She held it there anyway. The way you hold your hand against something that hurts, because the hurt, at least, is real. "You remember the hands that shaped you?" she said softly. "Somebody spent a long time on you. Somebody thought you were worth the effort." She walked away before the gates opened and didn't look back. But had she looked back, she would have seen the stone where her palm had rested. It was fractionally, impossibly warmer than the granite surrounding it. Chapter 3. The morning. It changed. Late autumn turned the city amber and rust, and Marin had been in Veldrath for almost 4 years. On a morning cold enough that her breath made small, brief ghosts in front of her, she arrived at the gates to find a man standing in front of her wolf. He was tall, very tall, with the broad-shouldered, dense physicality of a dominant shifter. He wore dark traveling clothes, plain enough that she took him for a courier or perhaps an off-duty guard. His back was to her. He had both hands pressed flat against the wolf's stone flank, in the exact posture she'd used weeks ago, and never repeated, and he was very still. She slowed, uncertain. This was her routine, her small private ceremony, and his presence in it felt like discovering someone in a room you'd thought was always empty. She almost turned away. Instead, she walked up beside him and stood looking at the wolf the way she always did. "He's the good one," she said, by way of explaining her position. "The other one's technically more perfect. No damage, but this one has the better expression." The man turned his head. His face was angular and severe, the bones of it placed with the deliberate economy of a sculptor working in expensive material. His eyes were a gray so pale they looked like the sky 30 seconds before snow. The dominance aura hit her like stepping into a headwind. Not unpleasant exactly, but pressuring. The way deep water pressures the ears. She'd lived near dominant shifters all her life. She neither flinched nor submitted. Being wolfless meant the aura's command frequency had nowhere to land. He looked startled by that. "You come here often," he said. It wasn't a question. He'd been watching her, she realized. Not this morning, but before. The guards would have reported her. She was the laundress who talked to the stone. "Every morning for 4 years." She saw no reason to be embarrassed by it. "It's on my way." "What do you say to it?" "Today's news. Whatever's troubling me." She considered him for a moment. "The same things people say to graves, I suppose, except without the grief. It's more like talking to something that will still be here regardless." Something moved in those pale eyes. Not the expression she expected, which was the tolerant bemusement of the powerful encountering and eccentric. What she saw looked more like recognition. "Does it answer?" He'd asked it carefully, in a tone that suggested the question was not entirely metaphorical. "Not until today," she said, looking back at the wolf. She meant that it had answered by sending her a stranger who listened. She walked away before she could see how he received that. Chapter 4. The name that landed like a stone. She found out who he was by mid-morning. Betta appeared at the pressing tables with the electric walk of a person carrying news they had to put down before they burst. The king came back. "From where?" Marin set down a folded sheet. "The border survey, 3 weeks away. They say he came back early." Betta lowered her voice. "He came in through the front gates on foot. No escort. Nobody even recognized him until he was inside. The cold granite, the two pale eyes, the aura like deep water. Marin heard the description from Betta as if from a great distance, although Betta was 2 feet away, although the pressing room was warm and full of the smell of hot linen, and she was standing in it perfectly, solidly. Alpha King Karen Voss. She'd spoken to the Alpha King the way she spoke to the Stone Wolf, plainly, without ceremony, about whatever was in her head. She turned back to the pressing iron. Marin? Betta had noticed something. The tablecloths, Marin said, won't press themselves. She wasn't afraid, exactly. She was something more complicated than afraid. She was waiting for the consequence she'd learned to expect whenever she stopped being invisible. The consequence being, inevitably, that someone would remind her that she'd been wrong to take up space in the first place. The consequence came sooner than she expected. Dresta arrived at the linen door that afternoon with a face like locked gates. You spoke to the king this morning. I didn't know who he was. That's not a defense. Dresta looked at her with the particular discomfort of someone confronting a situation that didn't fit their categories. You're to go to the east receiving room. Now. I need to finish the... Now, Marin. It was the first time in 3 years that Dresta had used her name. Chapter 5. The East Receiving Room. The palace interior was more overwhelming than she'd imagined in 4 years of circling its exterior. Everything was enormous without being crude about it, the proportions done in that aristocratic way that made you feel the grandeur was simply natural rather than performed. A steward led her in silence to a room that was smaller than she expected. The walls were paneled in dark wood. A fire burned in a stone hearth, and there was Karen Voss, sitting in a chair that was conspicuously not a throne, with his long legs stretched out, and a cup of something hot held in both hands, looking like a man who was trying, with mixed success, to be ordinary. He looked up when she entered. The steward closed the door behind her. She stood in the middle of the room. You said it answered, Karen said. Through me. Did you mean that? She considered lying or softening it. Yes. How long have you been coming to it? 4 years. He set down the cup. The stone warm where you touched it. You know that's not natural. She hadn't known he'd noticed. She went still. Wolfless individuals sometimes have other things, she said carefully. My grandmother always said... She stopped herself. What did your grandmother say? She hadn't meant to bring her grandmother into a conversation with a king, but there was something in his attention, the quality of it, the way he actually waited for the answer. That was simply not what she'd been prepared for. She said every stone remembers the hands that shaped it. Marin looked at the fire. I thought she meant pottery. Now I think she may have meant something larger. The silence in the room was thoughtful rather than oppressive. The stone wolves were carved during the founding of this palace, Karen said slowly. They were made by an Omega named Solvain, who had no wolf form either. She was a stone singer, an ability we haven't seen in the bloodline since. He paused. Or thought we hadn't seen. Marin's palms went cold. I'm not a stone singer. You spoke to stone for 4 years and it retained the warmth of your hands. I felt it this morning. I've been standing at those gates for 3 days, early, trying to understand what I was feeling through the stone. It took your voice saying it was the good one to finally... He stopped. To finally what? He stood. He was very large in the small room, and not because he was threatening, simply because he was entirely present, no part of himself stored elsewhere. The wolf told me your name, he said. That morning, after you left. I had my hands on the stone and it, not in words, more like a vibration, a warmth, a direction. But I knew it was your name. She stared at him. What name did you hear? Marin, he said, and it landed the way her name had never once landed in 4 years at this palace. Like it meant something. Like it had weight and specific gravity and a place in the world. Chapter 6. What comes of being seen, She went back to work that afternoon because she didn't know what else to do, and because the tablecloth still needed pressing, and because the alternative was to sit in her small room and shake, which seemed unproductive. But things had shifted in the way that tectonic things shift, not visibly, but in the underlying structure. He began leaving things on the pedestal of the chipped ear wolf. First, a small bundle of dried herbs from somewhere farther south than Veldrath, tied with kitchen twine, left before she arrived the following dawn. No note. She knew it was him because no one else had any reason to leave anything on that pedestal, and because the gesture had the deliberate quality of a person who had thought hard about what to say before saying it without words. She left something back. She was not sure why, except that the herbs seemed to be an opening line in a different kind of conversation, and leaving them unanswered felt wrong. She left a small roll of good linen, the kind she set aside from undamaged remnants, cut and hemmed along both edges so it could be used as a handkerchief or a wrap for a small object. It was the finest thing she owned in terms of craft, if not in terms of material. The third morning, the linen was gone, and in its place was a small note that said only, "I had the stone wolves examined. The stone singer bloodline is real. I've asked 3 scholars. I'd like you to meet them. If you're willing." She looked up at the wolf's chip-eared face. "You got me into this," she told it. The morning after, she left her answer on the pedestal, a single word written on torn paper. When? The meetings with the scholars were strange, and then illuminating. They tested her with small pieces of raw stone, with carved fragments, with a slab of the same granite as the gate wolves. What they found agreed with what Chiron had suspected. Not magic in the dramatic sense, but something genuine and traceable, an ability to resonate with stone that had been shaped with intention, to read its memory, and in very old or deeply worked pieces, to add new memory to them. Every stone remembers the hands that shaped it, her grandmother saying. Her grandmother, who had lived her whole life in a village with a stone wall she'd never stopped touching. "This doesn't change what I am," she told Karen in the East receiving room again, which had become a place she associated with difficult truths delivered without cruelty. "I'm still wolfless. I still have no pack standing, no rank in any hierarchy." "I know." He wasn't conceding a point. He was agreeing with a fact, and doing so without apparent regret. "That isn't what I'm interested in." "What are you interested in?" He was quiet for a long moment. The fire popped and settled. "You talked to a stone wolf every morning for 4 years," he said, "because it was present and reliable and didn't require you to perform anything. You gave it your real thoughts, the small hard ones and the ones about home." He looked at her steadily. "I have been king for 9 years. In 9 years, no one has spoken to me the way you spoke to that stone." She understood then what he was saying, and also how much it had cost him to say it. "You were lonely," she said, not as an accusation, but as someone recognizing a landscape they'd traveled themselves. "Comprehensively," he said. Chapter 7. The Pack Council and the Winter Feast. It was not simple after that. Nothing real and worth having is simple. The Pack Council, 7 alpha representatives of the great Veldrath families, who met each season to advise the throne, heard within a week that the king was spending time with a wolfless laundress who spoke to stone. The reaction was what Marin had predicted, which was why she'd never been surprised by it. Lord Herrick, eldest of the council and custodian of the bloodline registries, requested a formal audience at which Marin was not present, because she held no standing. She found out what was said through Karen afterward, who told her with a directness she had come to recognize as one of his characteristics. "They said your bloodline is contaminated. That a wolfless consort would weaken pack standing. That stone zinging is an old wives' tale, and you're probably a confidence artist." He paused. "They were very thorough." "And?" "I told them that the last Omega to speak to the stone wolves was the woman who founded this palace. That if her bloodline is contamination, the whole city is contaminated." His jaw was set. "I also told them that I have been advised by this council for 9 years, and not one of them has ever said a true thing to me without wrapping it in a strategy first." The winter feast was 3 weeks later, Marin was included in the staff allotment, not as a guest. Not yet, that was a battle for another season. But by Karen's direct order, her name was included in the register as a recognized member of the palace auxiliary. She received the feast bonus. She received the proper designation. Dresta announced this to the staff with the expression of someone eating something complicated. Marin finished pressing the ceremonial tablecloths, the same ones from months ago, now needed again, and said nothing. But at the feast itself, which she worked as laundry staff were sometimes permitted to do at the edges of large events, she looked across the crowded hall and found the king's pale gray eyes already on her, patient and specific, the way they always were now. Not scanning the room and landing on her, but watching the doorway she always used because he'd learned which one it was. She pressed two fingers briefly against the stone doorframe. She felt the warmth of it. Old stone touched by a century of hands, and she let it feel her back. Across the hall, Karen's expression shifted into something that was almost private, almost not for public viewing. Chapter 8. What She Said at Dawn. The last morning she came to the wolf alone. It was deep winter, the ground iron hard, and the stars only just beginning to fade when she arrived. She stood in front of the chipped ear wolf, with her hands in her coat pockets, and she looked at it for a long time without speaking. Then she said, "I don't know what I'm doing." The city was very quiet. The cold had a presence of its own, the way cold does at a certain depth. Not hostile, just extremely real. "I know what he feels," she continued. "I know it because the stone told me, and because of how he looks at me, and because lonely people recognize each other. But I am wolfless, and he is the Alpha King, and in every story, this is the part where the thing that can't happen doesn't happen." She touched the wolf's flank, not gripping, just contact. "So I'm asking you. You've been here longer than any of this. You knew Solvayne. You knew every hand that ever rested on you. What do you actually remember?" The warmth came up through the stone to meet her palm. Not imagination. Actual warmth. The kind that built slowly. The way a held hand warms. And then, softly, not in language, but in some older register between feeling and knowing, she understood what the stone remembered. It remembered being raw granite before the sculptor came. It remembered the first chisel strikes, which were tentative. It remembered the sculptor learning it, the way you learn a person, their resistances, their natural lines, where to follow and where to lead. It remembered many mornings and many hands and the slow accumulation of being known. It did not remember any hand the way it remembered hers. She stood there for what might have been 5 minutes or half an hour, and then she heard footsteps on the cobblestones behind her. Karen was not dressed for an audience. He had his travel coat and his plain boots and no crown. She had still never seen him in the crown, and he stopped a few feet away, with his breath making small ghosts in the cold air. "I thought you might be here." He looked at the wolf, and then at her. "I wanted to say something before another day went by, and I talked myself into being more careful about it." She waited. She was very good at waiting. "I want you to stay," he said. "Not at the linen door. Here, in the palace. As," he paused, choosing the word with the care of someone who knew that this word, in particular, once placed, changed everything. "As mine, if you want that." In a different story, she might have argued about her unworthiness, her wolfless state, her lack of standing. But Marin Ashvale had been invisible for 4 years in a city that didn't see her, and she had spent those years learning, very precisely, what she was worth. The wolf had helped. The stone had helped. Her grandmother had helped, from a long distance and several years of death. She turned to face him fully. "I want to tell you something first," she said. "Not because it's a condition, because it's true, and I think you've spent enough years around people who withhold true things for strategic reasons." He inclined his head. His eyes were the color of the sky just now, lightening at the horizon. "I was waiting for this," she said. "Not for a king, not for the Alpha. For you specifically, the one who stood at the gate for 3 days before dawn, with his hands on cold stone, trying to understand what he felt. She looked at him steadily. "I have been alone for a long time in this city. You are the first person who has spoken to me the way the wolf speaks, truly, without needing me to be useful first." Something in his face changed, deeply and permanently, the way things change when they finish becoming what they were always meant to be. He crossed the remaining distance between them. His hands, when they found her face, were warm despite the cold, the warmth of someone who ran hotter than the world around him, who had been containing a great deal of heat for a long time. When he kissed her, it was the way the first chisel strikes a stone, tentative and then certain, and then increasingly at home. Behind them, on its pedestal, the chipped ear wolf held its ancient watching posture. The granite in one spot, the size of a hand on its left flank, glowed faintly warm in the winter dark, the way things glow when they remember something worth keeping. Epilogue. 1 year later. Winter came back the way it always does in Veldrath, carrying its cold with the self-assurance of something that knows it will be obeyed. Marin stood at the front gates in a coat that was better than last year's, though the palace had tried to give her several that were finer still, and she'd declined the more elaborate ones on grounds of practicality. Her hair was the same old honey color, still managing that amber and dark gold trick in the early light. The title that now preceded her name in the palace registers, Consort, Veldrath Palace, Stone Singer Bloodline Recognized, had not, to her private satisfaction, changed anything about how she stood at dawn. She still came every morning. The wolf looked back at her with its chipped ear and its permanent alert expression, and she stood beside it the way you stand beside something that has known you across a long and improbable distance. In her coat pocket, her right hand was wrapped around a small object, a piece of granite, no larger than a hen's egg, which Cairn had cut from the excess material of a palace repair 6 months ago. The scholars had wanted to test it. Marin had kept it instead, carrying it daily since autumn, talking to it in idle moments the way she'd always talked, about linens, about weather, about the particular texture of a morning. It was warm in her hand. It had been warm since the first day. Footsteps behind her, and Cairn arrived with his plain coat and his travel roughness and his pale eyes that had learned the exact angle of light in which she looked most like herself. He stood beside her in front of the wolf. "What did you tell it today?" he asked. "That you snore." She considered. "And that I'm happy. I wanted it to know both things." His hand found hers in her pocket, closing around both her fingers and the small piece of granite between them. "Your grandmother's saying?" he said. "I've been thinking about it." "What about it?" "You said you thought she meant pottery. Then you thought she meant something larger." He looked at the wolf's stone face, at the chisel marks 200 years old that made up its expression. "I think she meant people. That every person remembers the hands that shaped them. The ones that came early and rough, and the ones that came later and patient, and the ones that finally found the natural lines." Marin looked at the wolf. She looked at the warm stone in her hand. She thought about her grandmother's cottage, the chimney she'd run her fingers along before bed, searching for a memory she hadn't had the words for yet. "Yes," she said. The city woke around them in its stages, bakers, draymen, market sellers. The sky moved from charcoal to pewter, to the pale silver pink that preceded actual dawn. The stone under Marin's palm remembered the sculptor who had been uncertain at first and then at home. It remembered every hand that had rested there across 2 centuries of Veldrathi winters. It remembered Marin, 4 years of her small true words, her grief and her news, and the morning she'd said you were worth the effort to a piece of rock because it needed to be said. Every stone remembered. And the ones that were very lucky remembered being loved